5 4 3 2 1
You're listening to the United States of Oklahoma with Josh Delaney. I am Delaney, podcasting unlive from the corner of Main and Robinson in downtown Oklahoma City. It's a beautiful day out there today. And our guest today is a clinical and forensic psychologist. He is the former director of forensic psychology at the Oklahoma Forensic Center in Vinita.
Correct.
Thank you. He consults with police departments and on hiring evaluations and things like that. And he has taught at local universities and colleges. And there was one more thing I wanted to get in here. Where is it? Oh, he's been he's testified at many high-profile trials in Oklahoma. So would that make you an expert witness?
Yes.
An expert witness and an expert guest, Dr. Sean Roberson. What's up, man?
Not much.
So with all of that introduction, what are your thoughts on Hannibal Lecter?
Well, it's an interesting movie. Definitely a psychopath.
A psychopath? How so?
Well, I'd say there are two main components to psychopathy. One is affective, or how people feel. Certainly doesn't have much remorse for what he did, or empathy for others. And then behaviorally, psychopaths tend to be sensation-seeking and oftentimes manipulative and can be quite violent in some cases.
Yeah. Do they have a particular look in their eyes?
No, I'd say not.
No.
Okay. Other than anger, if you challenge.
Other than anger? Yeah. What's there's like a sanpakko. There's some kind of Japanese word that talks about the eyes, and if you have the whites above or the whites below, that means you're a certain type of person. It's probably an internet myth.
Not familiar with that.
So what you been up to lately? We haven't talked in about 6 months since you were part of the Logan Tucker 6-part true crime podcast.
Well, still in private practice, doing mainly criminal forensic work, doing evaluations for attorneys in various organizations, district attorneys around the state and state cases, defense attorneys, private defense attorneys, as well as some of the public defenders. And then is at the federal level as well, doing some work for the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Federal Public Defender. That keeps me pretty busy. And then my work with the Oklahoma City Police Department doing pre-hire evaluations. And then I'll begin teaching at UCO's Forensic Science Institute again in the fall.
Okay. When you do evaluations for cops, is that how is that different from maybe doing hiring evaluations for another industry? Are there set guidelines? Is it something you've come up with yourself or combination?
No, there's some general guidelines for evaluations in law enforcement. So obviously you're going to get into questions that relate to what the job entails, dealing with the public. You know, how do you deal with hostility from the public? How do you know when use of force is required? Talk about different job-related activities. And there's also psychological testing that's been specifically normed to police officer candidates, as well as people who've been on the job for a period of time. And it compares how they score to those groups. So you can see, are they generally in the norm? Are they outside the norm in some way? And if so, why?
Have you had to tell a police department, do not hire this guy? It's not a good fit.
There have been very few occasions, but it does happen.
What brings up a red flag for you when you're evaluating somebody who wants to be a cop and probably shouldn't be?
You know, more often than not, it's if they can't produce a valid psychological test. And so many of the psychological tests that we give have validity scales to look and see, are people being honest? Are they trying to present themselves in an overly favorable light? Or in the case of criminals, make themselves look mentally ill?
Yeah.
Oftentimes. And so if they can't produce a valid psychological inventory, that's one key concern. The other might be certain responses that they would give. You know, obviously, if they seem to be a heavy-handed type of individual who is not thoughtful towards their actions or has some kind of, you know, bias towards certain groups that might exclude them from working in law enforcement. By the time they see me, though, they've already undergone such a rigorous background investigation yeah. that it's unlikely I'm going to uncover anything.
Yeah, yeah. Do you get reports before you go and interview them or give them an evaluation?
It depends on the agency. Some reports provide me their background details and some don't. Anytime there's any question, though, I'll always call an agency and say, you know, I saw something that concerned me. Here's what it was. And I might inquire for more information about their background.
Do people who get into psychology, is it true that all of them have had some kind of childhood trauma that they're trying to deal with?
You know, that's certainly often said. I would say there's an overabundance of people in psychology who may have had some personal issues to work out at some point in their lives that made them interested in therapy. I've never, you know, that's a good question. I've never actually seen a study on that. That would make a really interesting study. It would not shock me if it was above the norm.
Yeah, yeah. Long story short, I was, I don't want to get too personal here, but let's just say I was in a counseling session. And I had done 3 counseling sessions. These were not therapy sessions, listeners out there. All right, I'm going to keep it very vague. But the point is, in the middle of the third one, the counselor looked at me and he goes, "Have you ever thought about getting into psychology? You're really good at this." It was just the oddest moment.
Did that concern you a little?
A little bit, yeah. I thought, well, gee, am I helping you out? What's going on here? That was my last session. But he was a great guy, though. He's a great guy. What drew you into psychology? About what point in your life did you realize this is something I really want to pursue?
You know, it really wasn't until about midway through college. I initially thought I might go into law, was interested in law, wasn't sure I wanted to work in the courtroom necessarily at that point, wasn't sure if I wanted to work the kind of hours that I, you know, have ended up working now. And I had a friend of my father's was a professor at UCO. David Mitchell was his name. And I met David and had a chance to be around him and got exposed to psychology a little bit there. Took some psychology classes and really got to see the scientific side of psychology, the behavioristic side, where there's actually mathematical formulas and statistics and things that are beyond just therapy. And that really fascinated me.
Yeah. How much, you got your doctorate, so how much school, how old were you when you graduated, when you got your doctorate?
I was 29 when I received my doctorate. I finished my bachelor's at 20, right before I turned 22. I received a master's in experimental psychology, which is basically like statistics and research at UCO when I was 23. And then went into my doctorate. And with the PhD, you have to go through not only the coursework, but then you've got a year of dissertation and a year of internship.
Are there different tracks for clinical versus forensic? How does that work? Do you take those at the same time?
Well, there are actually 3 primary ones. And my doctorate's actually in counseling, but there's clinical counseling and school psychology. Typically. Now, there are others. There's social psychology and cognitive psychology. But if you're talking about the practice of psychology and being a licensed psychologist, it's typically you're either in clinical counseling or school. There's not much difference between clinical and counseling anymore.
Okay. You're still doing counseling?
I don't. I've actually not done therapy much of my career at all. I did a little bit when I was at the Forensic Center. But primarily as a forensic psychologist, the job is to focus in on assessments.
Okay, because I was going to ask you why do these therapists draw out these sessions? You know, just trying to bleed money out of us is that what they're doing?
Well, it depends on how deep your problems are.
They all seem to get deeper as soon as we walk through those doors.
That 3 just times means they're good at uncovering it.
I think the guy just wanted to hang out. I was like, bro, let's just go to the bar, man. It's a lot cheaper.
You can't bill insurance, though.
Right. I'm going to lobby for that. How does one get into – okay, so what is What is forensic psychology? What is that?
So forensic psychology is anything related to the law and the application of psychology. And so it can be criminal is what's typically thought of. So doing competency to stand trial, insanity evaluations, dangerousness. But it's also, evaluating parents who are involved in custody disputes. It can be evaluating, grandmother whose estate's in dispute and the family's fighting over whether or not she has dementia and where the money's going to go. Basically, it's anything where a psychologist gets drawn into a legal situation.
And you've testified at trials?
I have.
Have you testified for both the defense and the prosecution?
I have, many times.
All right. Which one of them pays you more?
Equal.
Equal, okay.
Yeah. That's one thing you learn early on. You better charge everybody the same amount or, you might look a little biased.
Yeah. When they approach you, I guess if you get subpoenaed, you have to, right?
Correct.
Do you? Okay. Do you ever testify and go, I don't want to be used on behalf of this team over here. I don't really like this case. I think they have a weak case or, stuff like that.
That rarely happens. Usually the attorneys are smart enough not to call you if it's going to be disadvantageous to what they're trying to prove. But I can't say that always happens. So really the worst thing that happens is when you have a side that brings you into court and they take no time to prepare with you. They don't tell you what they're going to ask. And they start asking you questions that you can't answer, don't make sense, or undermines their own argument.
Well, are there unscrupulous folks out there that will take money and testify to whatever, whatever you need?
A good portion of my profession. Yes. There's a book written several years ago called Whores for the Court, which outlines the practice of forensic psychologists and psychiatrists. And I would say in large part, there are many experts around the state and the nation that the lawyers know who to call for what.
Okay. Like testimony for hire.
Correct.
Good grief. How much can somebody make to testify during a case?
I have seen experts charge. I would say the average rate here in Oklahoma for forensic work is going to be anywhere from about $175 to $225 per hour. But I've seen some people here in the state as well as around the nation who charge upwards of $500 an hour. I've seen some of the fee agreements that I've seen are pretty interesting, and they'll outline, I'm going to get $2,000 a day, and if I have to fly across the country, it's going to be in first class. And some of the stipulations of these agreements are quite surprising.
Rock stars out there.
Yeah.
Good grief. So what are a couple of the bigger cases that you've trials that you've testified at?
My testimony was brief, but in the Adacia Chambers case and the Stillwater case where she ran into the parade, they did have me evaluate her competency, and the judge met with me in chambers beforehand, and they also had me speak briefly in court about my opinion about her competency. But I didn't formally take the stand because she ended up pleading guilty.
Okay. Do you interview folks like that at prison or at another type of center? Or
it's usually dependent upon the type of crime they have. So I have done roughly probably 175 murder cases. And in almost all those cases, they're going to be locked up in a county jail. That's usually where you're going to see them. Now, occasionally, if it's less serious than that, they're going to be out on bond. They may come to my office. I may go to see them. I may, in some cases, if it's post-conviction, I may actually go out to the prison where they're at. I've gone to death row on a few occasions. Early this year, I went out to Hominy, to Dick Connors Correctional Center.
You're a veteran at this now, but at any point, was it nerve-wracking to have to deal with somebody who's probably murdered somebody? Assuming, of course, that, they're not all guilty, of course, but
right, and I go on that assumption that they're not all guilty, but certainly you want to, go into it with safety in mind. I evaluated a guy a few years back who had killed somebody, and found out afterwards he'd been found with a shank, and nobody had told me that before I saw him, and you probably heard of the case of Kevin Sweat, who was convicted for shooting the two girls from Waletka. And at his sentencing hearing, my understanding is he pulled out a razor blade and cut his attorney's throat. So, you know, you see somebody like that, you certainly want to be cautious.
Yeah, I've got a shank on me right now. It's a left sock.
I'll keep an eye on that.
Okay. If you see me kicking, you know what's coming. So about 175 cases. Can you peg percentage-wise how many were deemed that they couldn't go to trial because of their mental condition?
So I'll speak to first I'll speak to what the national rate is, which is around 25 to 35%, and that's in the initial evaluation. Now they're going to get most of those people competent through treatment. My rates over the years have typically varied right within that realm. Some years it's been closer to 20, some years it's been as high as close to 35, depending upon, you know, how many people I saw that year. Generally about a third of your people are going to be found incompetent initially, and then they're going to be treated and almost all of them are going to be restored to competency.
What makes them incompetent, and then what brings them back up to that threshold where they are competent?
Number one reason by far is severe mental illness makes them incompetent. You get a small percentage of people with intellectual disabilities and a small percentage of people with dementia or brain injuries or some other cognitive issue going on. So it's usually mental illness. It's usually it's always going to be severe mental illness. You're not going to be incompetent because you have ADD or that you're mildly depressed. You're typically going to have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or some other severe condition. And psychotropic medication's the number one way they're going to get competent. You know, therapy's good, but you can't talk people out of having hallucinations.
Yeah, yeah. Is crazy an appropriate term, or is it inappropriate?
That would be considered inappropriate.
Okay, all right. I'm like, crazy how that is. How easy is it for, you know, somebody who's facing trial to fake their way out of having to testify? Is it like the movies where they think if they act incompetent enough that somehow they'll go to a hospital for a few years and then get put out on the street?
Is that like Ed Norton in Primal Fear?
Right. Is it like that?
Yeah. You know, the simple answer to that is it depends on who you see and what their skill level is and how thorough they are. So the research suggests that by and large, mental health professionals are very easily fooled. And that's one of the major problems with my profession, is that they, you know, it's a helping profession, it's a therapeutic profession, but they take people generally at their word. And so there's research out there that says that most untrained college students can go into a counselor's office and can endorse enough items to get a diagnosis of major depression or PTSD. Obviously, faking psychosis becomes a little bit more complicated, but I can tell you through reviewing thousands of files over the years, you know, mental health professionals from all levels, psychiatrists, psychologists, master's level, are all easily fooled. The way that we can detect malingering is, one, you gain skill at it over time, but two, we rely on objective testing measures. So tests that take the clinician's judgment out of it, because you can't always tell. I can still be fooled. There are also times when I think somebody's malingering and they're not, according to the testing. And so having some measure of objectivity combined with your own subjective perceptions of them, and then just gathering the data and really putting all the data together and challenging things and comparing what they tell you versus what's known.
What is the self-esteem level of a typical criminal?
You know, that would really probably depend widely on the individual. I don't know that I've ever seen a study on that. Oftentimes, they're pretty guarded, pretty jaded type of individuals, and so they're certainly going to present with a tough exterior. And it may also vary greatly based on men versus women. I'm not sure how to answer that.
Are there patterns that you've seen in people that have been charged with murder, gone to trial, been convicted? Or do you see certain elements that just run through most of the time?
Well, the number one predictor of future violence is past violence. The number two predictor is substance use. So one thing that I, whenever I teach my class, whenever I talk to the public, that I really try to educate people on is that mental illness does not drive much crime. Most criminals are not acting that way because they're mentally ill. They're acting that way because they are engaged in criminalistic thinking and criminalistic behavior. We call those criminogenic factors. And the research clearly shows that's what drives crime. So it's this great myth that we see perpetuated, saying that all these people in jail, that all these people in prison, if we would just help their mental health, we wouldn't have a problem with crime. No, that's not why they're doing what they're doing. Now, some of them may have mental health issues, but that's not what's driving their criminal behavior.
As you say, I need to be objective. Why do you think that myth is out there?
One, I think it's perpetuated by my own profession. I've got a colleague who's one of the leading researchers on crime and looking at mental illness in prison settings. And whenever he gives speeches, he says the room is completely silent when he talks about how criminogenic factors are what we need to treat and address. So our profession likes to kind of couch people as not as being as responsible for the behaviors maybe they are, and that we need, if we could just treat them, if we could help them in some way, we could fix this. I think the other thing is that it's often used for an argument within public funding. If we just had more money in this area, we could stop crime. Now, granted, there are community programs, there are things that can be put in place that might help. But let's not fool ourselves and think that everybody is, you know, robbing a store or is committing an assault because voices are telling them to do that. You rarely see the insanity defense used. So let me ask you this. If mental illness driving most crime, why aren't defense attorneys using the insanity defense? Mm-hmm. You just don't see it a lot.
Right. It seems to be playing a lot into the issue of criminal justice reform too. That seems to be a talking point. Again, listener, I'm being objective. I'm just pointing stuff out. But do you agree with that? Is that something you're seeing in the discussion around criminal justice reform?
Oh, absolutely. It's a big topic in psychology. Psychology is a very social activist field. If you looked at the American Psychological Association's amicus briefs that they file with the Supreme Court, that they file with state courts, if you looked at the cover of their magazine, The Monitor, you know, they focus on issues like criminal justice reform and immigration and global warming. Now, I'm not sure how much people would typically think psychology has to do with that, but psychology is very involved in criminal justice reform.
Yeah. Does the sun need therapy or something?
It's our behavioral use of energy. And okay. How we approach it. And in fact, I believe the title on the front of the magazine was "Can Psychology Save the Earth?"
Well, I think it can, since you're here. I would have never have thought about that. But I've got a theory since I've been in journalism that is, I could think of the oddest thing to write about, and somewhere a college professor has written a paper on it, and I can call them up and get them to talk for 3 hours about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So does this just mean you're a big old meanie and a crank and why aren't you a nice guy? We're trying to help people out and this is wrong. Our jails and prisons are full and we should be opening up more community health clinics and things like that.
Sure. I worked a case pro bono just recently where it was a criminal defendant allegedly committed a very heinous act. Couldn't afford an evaluation. I didn't think the evaluation he'd had was proper. I saw him. He was so clearly incompetent, and he had been found incompetent by the examiner, or found competent by the examiner, that I took my time to write a report for this man. You know, I don't want to see people charged with criminal offenses who are innocent. I do evaluations of people in alleged false confession cases. I've done a fair amount of pro bono work for defendants. But the thing about it is we are supposed to be scientists. I mean, that's why psychologists are allowed in court. We're not there to just talk about what our political feelings are or what we think ought to occur. And much of what we're discussing here with criminal justice reform is really a moral decision. And so for us as psychologists to try to pretend that science weighs in on morality, I think is a problem. For example, many people in juvenile certification cases will give opinions about whether the juvenile should be tried as an adult or youthful offender or juvenile. To me, that's a court decision. That's a moral decision to make. What is the best interest of that kid? What is the best interest of society in general? And so I think that we really need to limit what our expertise is. I also think we need to be honest. I mean, you see a lot of stuff in the media where they will talk about, you know, Joe Blow was given 20 years for having a small sack of weed, but what they don't tell you is that he had 10 priors that included 3 assaults. And so when you're working inside the criminal justice system, you know, are all people treated fairly? No, people are not always treated fairly. But I also don't want to see necessarily the system demonized. It's what is our best use of resources? Who do we really need to have locked up? But let's be honest about it and not get politics involved in everything.
Mental illness seems like, well, it's not either a vague concept now or a big concept, or many things are being packaged into that word in terms of definition. What is mental illness?
Depends on who you talk to. So you summed it up.
So I'm not wrong.
Pretty much everything
I'm
is labeled.
Confused.
Yes.
Okay.
Pretty much everything is labeled to be a quote mental health issue nowadays. You know, I view from a forensic standpoint mental illness to be something severe, something that is largely out of an individual's control. That is psychosis, a manic state, severe depression, where the person cannot simply will themselves out of bed or will themselves into a state of not being despondent or suicidal. That's very different than the day-to-day depression and anxieties that many of us that we all feel. And also a lot of what we see are personality disorders. So that's not talked about much. And a lot of the people in the criminal justice system have personality disorders that get mislabeled as mental illness.
What's a personality disorder?
Personality disorder is essentially a dysfunctional way of thinking, feeling, or behaving. And it is severe enough that it interferes with your life in terms of your job, your relationships, your own safety. Maybe, you know, you're getting locked up over it. You have many different types of personality disorders, you know, antisocial, narcissistic, borderline, paranoid. Many of these personality disorders share common traits with mental illnesses. And so people get labeled as being mentally ill when it's really just their personality attributes.
I have seen on social media over the last 5 years, people posting very personal details about their life in this area. They will say, and they often do it in a way that comes off as helpful. Hey, I'm taking this treatment because I'm dealing with this issue, this depression, and I urge you all to talk about it, be open with it, don't hide it. You need to talk to somebody. I've often wondered, at the risk of sounding like a jerk, are people gravy training this concept of depression and mental illness and saying, I have that too? Are a lot of people misdiagnosing themselves, do you think?
I'm sure that frequently happens. But moreover, I think in the age of social media, our society, and this is my personal opinion, not a scientific opinion, our society is becoming increasingly self-absorbed and narcissistic. And so people constantly want to talk about themselves, see themselves on social media, draw attention to themselves in one way or another. And so they may share things about themselves that, you know, years ago we would not have with virtual strangers.
Hmm. Does it delegitimize real mental illness, real depression, you know, when maybe people kind of casually talk about whatever pills they're taking and want to look like they're struggling? I'm not judging them, and I don't even know if I'm couching this correctly. It just seems to be everywhere I turn today, somebody has some kind of mental issue. that they are saying that they have.
Right. Somebody's on a medication they're getting for one mental health reason or another.
And, yeah.
You know, that's a common complaint, I think, among people within my profession is, and it's my personal perception is that, you know, psychotropics are great for people who need them. They've saved lives. I mean, if you're hearing voices, if you've got severe depression, if you've got bipolar disorder, therapy isn't going to necessarily be the cure-all for that. You're going to need some medication. But many of the problems that we all have, a pill isn't going to make it go away, because the problem is how you're living your life, the things you tell yourself, the people you surround yourself with. You really need to focus on how are you going to change your life or whatever the problem is that's causing the source of dissatisfaction that the pill isn't going to make go away.
Mm. Are you able to prescribe medication?
No. Psychologists in most states cannot. There are a few exceptions.
It's the psychiatrists.
Correct.
That can do that. But I'm sure you're familiar with the drugs that are out there.
Most of them, yes.
What's the most popular one right now that the doctors are handing out in, Pez dispensers?
Well, yeah. You see a lot of the same medications for sure.
Yeah. Prozac, is that still popular?
Yeah, that's a pretty popular antidepressant. Wellbutrin would be another one.
Yeah. Ativan, I think that was getting big for a while.
Ativan for anxiety oftentimes, yeah. And then a lot of the stimulant medications, you know, you get a lot of abuse of those as well.
Yeah. Jack Daniels.
<That's> that would be a depressant. But not far from Xanax.
Oh, okay, good. Is there a... I'm going to really diverge now. Is there a psychology to people who either drink when they're down or drink to get up, or people who will not drink if they're ever down? They just drink because, hey, it's time to celebrate.
I've not researched this recently, but when I was in graduate school, there was quite a bit of thinking about there being a quote, addictive personality. And from what I understand, there was not really any research to back that up.
I have heard that for decades, that was a real thing.
That's a common thing that people say. Now, are there some commonalities among addicts? I'm sure there are. And oftentimes, though, these are going to be dysfunctional ways of thinking. I mean, you go to an AA meeting, you go to an NA meeting, they're going to talk about a lot of the same, what we would call in psychology, cognitive errors that people make. You know, things they tell themselves that lead to relapse, that lead to using. And those are going to be common things among addicts. But are they all alike? No.
Well, does that knock a hole in the notion that you come from a long line of alcoholics, therefore you better not pick up the bottle because then you're going to be an alcoholic?
I think that's difficult to discern. I feel that that's oftentimes largely overplayed, that most of the, almost any human trait, if you look at it, is going to be a combination of genetic factors, environmental factors, and the interaction thereof, the social issues around us. But to look at any one individual and say, well, you know, because your dad was this, well, how do you know their dad didn't start drinking for some reason that was completely unrelated to genetics. And so they don't necessarily carry a gene down. Really, I think we need to focus in not so much on what is the cause, but what is the cure, right? Now, if we can determine there's some gene that identifies alcoholism, certainly we want to know what that is, or whatever the addiction may be, or aggression, or whatever it might be, whatever human trait it is. But we cannot necessarily know whether it's chicken or the egg.
What are your thoughts on, not AA, but alcoholism? Does a person need to quit cold turkey? Is that the only way to do it, or?
You know, that's not really my area of expertise, but I will say there's research in recent years that has said that there are perhaps other successful ways of cutting down. But by and large, most of the people that I have personally evaluated who have recovered don't still occasionally use. They become abstinent. Now we're talking about people who were chronically alcoholic, chronically drug dependent. I deal with drugs probably more than alcohol in terms of the severe addictions. And, you know, you can't just occasionally use meth and still not slip back into that addiction. They're even going to have relapses. You expect relapses. But eventually, the people who stay sober long term tend to be sober long term and not continue to use.
Now, circling back to criminal justice, are they are prisoners getting over prescribed in prison as well, or no, or where's that at?
Well, I've definitely got some strong opinions on that.
I'm shocked.
Yes, yes. if you look at even the numbers, and I believe the Oklahoman did a story on this where they talked to the chief psychologist, the chief medical officer with DOC several years ago, and he talked about, you know, there had been a 300% increase in psychotropic medication. They were really getting to the root of treating a lot of these prisoners who had mental health problems. So that leads the question, well, how do they determine if people have mental illness in prison? So you want me to give you the simple answer?
Give me the long answer. Well, give me the simple one, then we'll dive in.
The simple one is they asked them.
Good grief.
So most of the people...
Can you ask me if I'm mentally ill?
Yes. Are you mentally ill?
Yes.
There you go.
Give me some drugs.
And then we'll go through the types of problems that you have, and if you just say yes, 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 I give you a diagnosis and I give you a drug. That is essentially what I have personally seen happen in jails and in prison systems. So they have...
They just ask?
Yes. Yes, they go down a checklist.
You're going to get me 15 more guests in here.
They go down a checklist of symptoms. Now, I've challenged some people who are within the system about this, and they say, oh, no, that's not what we do. But then I know people who work in the system, and I ask them, do you use this test that we look at to see if people are faking mental illness? Do you use this test to see if people are faking cognitive problems or memory problems? No, they don't use them. They do not use objective measures by and large. Now, they may occasionally use a personality inventory or depression inventory or something like that, but we as psychologists have developed tests for malingering, which is essentially the faking of a disorder. We develop malingering tests because there's no research to suggest we can just tell if people are malingering. So if we can't just tell if people are malingering, why aren't we using the malingering tests with populations that we know are more likely to malinger? For example, people in prison, and don't even get me started on Social Security disability.
Well, let's go there, since we're since now I'm in big trouble. What the hell's going on with that?
Well, what's going on with that is that there are billions of dollars a year spent on Social Security disability evaluations and funding for that program, and they do not allow tests to see if people are faking it. We've got a wealth of scientific knowledge, many articles that show that large percentages of people who are on disability fake having cognitive problems or mental illness in order to get that monthly check. And Social Security, well, let me tell you this way. So when I first came into practice here in Oklahoma County, I had a colleague who, they really needed people to do evaluations. There was a long list of people to be seen, and Social Security really needed evaluators. So we met with their regional person, and he gave us the spiel, and we'd love to have you do evaluations. And me, coming from a forensic background, I said, well, how do you feel about malingering tests? And he said, well, we're not going to pay you for using any of those. And I said, well, what if that would be fine and I just gave them anyway and wouldn't charge you? And he said, if you put the word malingering in any of your reports, you're going to get a call from us, from one of our doctors. So they went ahead and sent me, and I did this as an experiment really for my criminal practice, because a lot of the people I see that are involved in the criminal justice system are on disability. So I went ahead and took the clients they referred to me. I saw them. I did malingering testing with a couple of them. I followed what he told me to do. I did not use the word malingering. I used the word faking.
I was going to ask.
And they never sent me another client again, and they wouldn't return my calls.
That's some Machiavellian move I would pull. Go to the thesaurus.
In fact, Senator Tom Coburn, who I'm sure you're familiar with, is a medical doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
He headed up an investigation in the Senate to look at why they weren't using malingering tests and demand it. They had a lead researcher in this area come, and they got letters back from Health and Human Services saying, well, yeah, those tests are all right, but they can't definitively tell, et cetera, et cetera. And it just went nowhere. It died. As you might know, Social Security ran out of money about a year ago, and Congress reallocated them, you know, a ton of money with no stipulation they actually have those objective measures.
So where does this money trail go back to? I assume
Well, it goes back to the taxpayer in the end. I mean, you're funding it, I'm funding it, everybody else out there is funding it.
Well, whose pockets does it go into?
Well, a government agency. So this government agency that oversees disability evaluations becomes larger, more important, the bigger it becomes. Just like within, let's say, the mental health section of a prison. If we've got more mentally ill prisoners, then my department becomes more important.
Man, you're going to get me. You've already got me in hot water. But, you know, we have all kinds of people on the show. You know, people just stay, you know, they say their thing, man.
I'm not always beloved for what I say.
I was going to say.
I'll tell you that. But I'm honest.
Have you been peer-reviewed?
I get peer-reviewed frequently. But everything I say, there's evidence to back it up for. I wouldn't say it otherwise. You know, I'll tell you right now, I think people who are on disability don't get enough money. I mean, the people I see who really are disabled, they cannot live on the $600 and something they get. It's a crime that's all we do for them. You know, we need to get rid of the large percentage of people that are scamming the system and give more money to the people who need our help.
So when you read an article dealing with any of these issues, the Oklahoman, national media, New York Times, LA Times, you're reading a news story. Do you see a lot of false premises in these stories? Are there sources that you believe the reporter should have talked to, that they're missing something? Are we carrying the water for people? What do we do well? What do we not do well when we write about mental illness, criminal justice reform, drug addiction?
I would not blame the reporters, the newspapers, or the media. Now, sometimes they might have their own personal bent on how they want a story to go, but they're relying on the experts. I mean, when you go pull Professor, Sumptyump from Harvard, you assume they know what they're talking about. But what you don't realize is it doesn't matter where somebody teaches, what their degree is. You know, you got to look at their data. Does their data actually say what they claim it says? And a reporter's not an expert in psychology or whatever other scientific area it might be. So you're just relying on somebody who has great credentials.
Yeah. I think there was a Twitter account. It might have gotten shut down, but it was all about peer reviews. And it looked at it looked at scientific papers, and it was just a lot of hokey subject matter. You know, like, I'll just make something up right now. Why a banana peel is the cause of Western patriarchy, or something like that.
Right.
So they would post stuff like that from journals and from college papers, and then also they would post retractions. Some study came out, it was peer reviewed, and it was touted in the media, and then 6 months later, a year later, 5 years later, they had to pull the whole thing. There was one group that had something called scientific paper generator, and you just gave them a topic and it would fill in a bunch of gobbledygook, a bunch of word salad, and they actually got those papers into conferences. I mean, not to down any more on your own profession, as you already have.
Well, let me give you an example that I give to my students. You're going to find this amazing. This is the typical stuff we see that really just drives me crazy. You know, I teach a forensic psychology class, and in the textbook I was reading, it was talking about handgun control and whether, what the level of access we should have to guns. You know, then again, I don't know that's necessarily a topic psychologists are experts on. But then again, the author waded into that, and he talked about how the great majority of the deaths in the United States due to handguns were violent crime. I thought to myself, that does not sound right. I don't think that's accurate. You know, and this is a book that our college students are reading. This author is the most respected forensic psychology textbook for undergraduates. It's used across the nation. So I, did a simple search and looked at the CDC Centers for Disease Control. And as I'm sure you may have heard at some point, the majority of handgun deaths are due to suicide. The great threat of handguns are depressed people or upset people hurting themselves. It's not violent crime. So why would that author put that in there?
Well, I'm going to have to go look that up now before I draw any conclusions. So people that get into psychology, how do they skew on the political spectrum? Is it 50-50, right and left?
Not even close. Okay. No, it's pretty pretty far left, I would say. There's not a lot of libertarians. There's not a lot of conservatives in psychology. It's mostly all liberal, which I don't necessarily disagree with a lot of the political platforms of liberals. But, you know, as a psychologist, I shouldn't be weighing in on that.
Yeah. Is that just because of their own personality types? I don't know. I've read more and more lately that you know, I'm kind of debating this idea. Not debating, but I meditate on it every now and then. How much free will do we really have, especially when it comes to worldview and outlook, versus how much of it is the chemical makeup?
Well, I think the American Psychological Association former president, Dr. I believe his name's Burkhoff, has an answer for you on that. And it was an article on why psychology should oppose the death penalty. And in that article, he said that free will is a human fiction, or is a legal fiction, something to that effect. He said it was created by lawyers, that free will was a fiction created by lawyers, that we are all just, you know, basically the sum of our environment. I don't personally believe that. I don't know how anybody ever gets sober if that's the case. And I don't know why we would have therapy if there's no free will.
Right, right. Okay, so you're not a psychological Calvinist.
I believe that certainly we can be heavily influenced by our environment. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. But to suggest that there's no free will, that we don't in large part make a lot of what goes on in our own lives, is I think that would be sad if that were true. And I think I'm not sure why we need therapy if that's the case, or therapists.
Yeah. Let me back up a little bit. There are these terms that we throw around in pop culture, in humor. I mean, I've done it a million times. I'm as guilty as anybody. But do you recoil when you hear somebody say something like, "God, that guy is psycho"?
Personally, no. You know, yeah, that would be considered very inappropriate within the mental health field.
But I mean, like out on the street or...
Yeah, you know, the things that I'm exposed to in the criminal justice system, I mean, I see the worst of the human nature. I see, you know, people who rape children and kill people and just do awful, human beings who do awful things to one another. And so, you know, you get a little jaded. And so I don't get as upset when I hear somebody use something that may be a term that's not as flattering. That doesn't mean, you know, I'm necessarily going to go throwing that out in court.
How smart are a lot of these let's just pick a category. How smart is the typical killer that you've interviewed and dealt with?
The lower end of average, I would say.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the majority of the criminal population that you deal with, by and large, are people who've been disadvantaged in some way. Okay. So they come from backgrounds that are, you know, not optimal many times, and so they haven't been given the educational opportunities, or if they had those opportunities, their home life was chaos, or maybe if they had a disorder themselves, they were kind of antisocial in nature. They didn't want to go to school. They didn't want to try to learn. And so this idea that psychopaths are all some kind of mad geniuses is really a myth.
Where did we get that from?
Movies, I think.
Yeah. Just reads well, looks well. Is that the Hannibal Lecter thing?
Exactly.
So is he a psychopath?
Yes.
Did we? Okay, I think we talked about that earlier. So how would you deal with him if you had to interview him?
I definitely want him in one of those, you know, jackets that has them with the face mask. Now, technically, you would probably see somebody like that on the other side of glass, which I've done one time in my career. There's only been one man that I've interviewed where I did not want to be in the same room with him. And it wasn't because he was mean or antisocial. He was just severely mentally ill, and he was the size of a mountain, and he could break a normal person's neck in about 3 seconds, and he was acutely psychotic. And in fact, they had to bring him into court in a jacket that would shock him if he went after somebody. He was so big that several deputies couldn't.
Oh, my God. Jeez. Are psychopaths, are they charming?
Yes, they can be. Now, so there, if you look at psychopathy, there are 20 different traits that are on the kind of the gold standard measure of psychopathy, the Hare psychopathy checklist. One of those traits is superficial and charming, essentially. And so they might seem charming initially, The more you're around them that and they've done the things that psychopaths do to you, that charm wears off.
My money's gone.
Right. Your money's gone. Your wife's gone.
And my heart's broken. Uh-huh. My nose is broken. How do they skew male-female? Are there more men than women that are psychopaths? Can women be psychopaths?
They can, but it's skewed way far towards men, just like crime in general is. Men tend to be more aggressive. Now, women, their crimes oftentimes or how they may act out aggression is going to be different than men. It's going to be relational rather than mm-hmm. physical.
Psychological torment.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Cold beds.
What's that?
Cold beds.
Cold beds. Cold beds, bad social media posts, things of that sort. Yeah. But, probably less than 10% of psychopaths would be women.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, does that mean if you get a woman who's a psychopath, that's like even worse than a man who's a psychopath? Because it's sort of a rare find.
Yeah, it would be rare, but I don't know that they'd be any worse because typically they're not going to have the physical capability that some of the men have just because of the stature. But they can be equally as dangerous.
Yeah. How soon, as you're talking about these issues, and maybe people that are listening are thinking along the same lines, I'm just thinking in terms of relationships. Is there a way that people can right off the bat recognize the psychopath, say, first 10 minutes, the first date? Or is it, hey, all of us really know what a psychopath is, but we kind of like the charm and the adventure of it?
No, I think most people probably have a misguided view of what psychopaths are. And you can't tell right off the bat unless you know kind of what the variables are related to psychopaths and that you've been around them for a period of time. So if you're going to evaluate somebody for psychopathy, and it's possible to evaluate them more than once, they typically recommend you try to see them more than once. They can be very charming. They can tell lies as if they're truth. Look you straight in the eye and not flinch. And you could confront them with information that clearly showed what they said was a lie, and it does not bother them. They'll quickly change their story. And so really with psychopaths, it is paying attention, not being blinded by all that charm, and paying attention to what their behavior is, what their past is. Does what they tell you match what you really see? And challenging them.
Are they ever trying to hide their psychopathy, or is this all just natural?
Only the really smart ones. Because typically they're so egotistical that they don't bother to hide their psychopathy.
Okay. I have a game I just thought of, but I was looking at the dark triad. I don't know if you heard the term dark triad traits. It's like psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism.
Okay.
So what's a narcissist? And that's one where I hear people, they'll call somebody a psychopath, but then they might refer to themselves jokingly as, oh, I'm such a narcissist. You know. Mm-hmm. So what is a narcissist?
Narcissistic personality disorder is the diagnosis that would relate to that. And that's a personality disorder that is just like what it sounds. I mean, basically they're focused on themselves. They have an unrealistic, inflated view of their own abilities and self-worth. Everything is about them. They really lack empathy towards other people. They're typically going to use other people without a lot of remorse. But it's got to be pervasive. You know, there's got to be a certain number of symptoms checked off, and then it's got to interfere with their functioning in some way for it to be a personality disorder. Many people have narcissistic traits. I mean, we all do that to protect our own ego to some degree. But it's just when it spins out of control to a level that it becomes psychopathology.
Are either of these things, I don't want to say fixable, manageable, psychopathy and narcissism? Do people even come to somebody and say, hey, I'm a narcissist, I'd like to get fixed?
I think I've seen that once. psychopathy, there was actually research several years ago in Canada that said, you know, we put psychopaths in group therapy, and what we found out of that was the psychopaths who were in therapy came out worse than the ones who didn't have it. The reason being is that they could learn how to hide their psychopathy. It improved their ability to manipulate people. Now, some research has refuted that that's the case. But by and large, if you have a narcissistic personality disorder, and you come in to see somebody for therapy, first of all, that's probably not going to happen because it's not your problem. It's everybody else's problem. And even then, when your therapist challenges you.
They're getting the therapy.
Right, right.
So when your therapist challenges you, you say no?
Yeah. You're going to say, what are you talking about? I'm great.
That's awesome. Well, it's not awesome. It's just kind of funny. I don't know. I've been around so many people. And I've done so many terrible things, but I've never been done.
If you want a good book on functional psychopaths, go look up Snakes in Suits by Robert Hare. Okay. And so Robert Hare was the man who defined psychopathy for the modern era and created the measure we use to look at psychopathy. And he wrote a series of books. But Snakes in Suits is one about, you know, functional psychopaths, people who are lawyers or doctors or, you know, psychologists. Or reporters.
Yeah, I know. A lot of those. There's a lot of narcissism in a newsroom. So we've had a lot of American presidents. Any past or present that would fall under any of those categories?
You know, people like to weigh in on that all the time. And since I'm here today as a psychologist, I won't give a comment because we're not supposed to say anything
that's
about people
right,
we've not directly
right.
evaluated.
Yes, that's right.
Do I have personal opinions about yeah, various people? Sure,
yeah.
Sure I do.
Well, there was a period there after Trump got elected where some people were calling for him to for psychologists, psychiatrists to weigh in, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But
you shouldn't do that because, as you said,
just because we have ethics codes doesn't mean we always follow them.
I am shocked again. okay, well, good stuff. I mean, I'm just always curious about this stuff. If somebody is in a tough relationship and they think somebody is a quote-unquote psycho, what are some things they should be looking for in the relationship?
I would say looking at, does their behavior match what they tell you, would be most important. Do they act in ways that are suspicious? I mean, it kind of comes down to investigating things. And this is not being paranoid. It's just a matter of – and not assuming people are lying to you. But it's just like when I do a forensic evaluation. I don't assume I'm being told the truth. I don't assume I'm lying. But I am going to look for data that matches or doesn't match what you tell me. Because if I start finding that you're not being honest with me about things, then it's going to lead me to question and I may dig a little more.
Mm. I can see better than I can hear. That's an old saying. You know, what you're telling me is not the, you know, not what I'm seeing here.
Well, and that's, I think, a large part of one thing we ought to focus in and the criminal justice system and oftentimes at sentencing and things like that is, you know, what are people telling you versus what do they do? So you see a lot of psychologists who will say, you know, Joe Blow is very remorseful for what he did. Last time I checked, we couldn't climb inside somebody's head and tell if they were really remorseful or not. So what I really like to talk about is how they tell us they're remorseful. And I'll talk about the behaviors that they've been engaging in that maybe demonstrate that or don't demonstrate that.
Dr. Sean Robertson, good to have you, man.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode of the United States of Oklahoma, please subscribe on your favorite podcast publishing platform, Triple P, man, and share with your friends. And if you want to keep up with the latest news in Oklahoma, pick up a digital subscription at oklahoman.com, where you will get unparalleled coverage of Sooner State politics, sports, breaking news, business, crime and courts, food, music, religion, and a whole lot more, including some of the best photojournalism around. All for $9.99 a month.